3, 5, and 6 probably come to memory for some of you. And maybe these are verses that you have spent time in before, and some, for some people, they've set these verses aside as their life verse. It's not going to be where we spend our time today, but I want to start there for sure. And I'd like for us to just say these words from Scripture together. So we'll put them on the screen for you. Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Those are good verses, a good promise, a good challenge. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. I don't know about you, but when I see those words applied to me, the words all your heart, in all your ways, I shudder a little bit. Because I know I can't really, and I haven't really, I probably won't really at all times, in all my ways and with all my heart at all times, all be trusting the Lord. But that challenge is there. It's held out as a promise, as an offer. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean on the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. And in all your ways, in every single way that you lean on him, that you acknowledge him, that you look to him, that you submit to him, in every single way that I trust him, he will direct my path. He will lead me in the way that he has for me. In every way that you acknowledge, look to, trust, lean on the Lord, he will come through for you every single time without exception. So trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him and he will direct your path or make your path straight. Now, how's this for a transition? I have a question for you. Have you ever thrown a baby? I know that some of you have. I have. I don't know why, but there is this instinct that we have sometimes when we hold a baby. Now, maybe not like a brand new baby, you know. I don't know what the rule is there exactly, but eventually they get to the point where you can't help yourself and you throw them, right? We throw them and we catch them, and we throw them and we catch them. Why do we do this? Where was that written? How did we learn it? Was it because of we saw someone else doing it? I have no idea where it came from. I don't know if it's traditional in some cultures and not traditional in others. But for whatever reason, at some point, probably they can hold their heads up and everything, we start throwing our babies. But what's even more amazing is that they love it. Have you seen this? They squeal. They're delighted. They laugh. They giggle. They kind of catch their breath. Now, some are a little bit more nervous than others. Maybe you have those ones in mind. But for the most part, they love it when we throw them up in the air. And I don't know, again, where the limitations are, how long you could do that. Probably as long as you can throw them up in the air. We don't go around throwing adults into the air. That would be a totally different experience, and you'd have to be very strong to do that. But we like to throw the kids up in the air, and what is it about that they enjoy so much? And why wouldn't you enjoy that? The difference, I think, of course, you know, the feeling is great, I guess. You know, it's like going down a slide or going through swings or on an amusement park ride or something. You know, it'll flutter in your stomach, and they love it, and they laugh, and they giggle. But why is that fun for them? It's because they have unquestioned certainty that they will be caught, right? The thought that maybe dad will lose his grip has not even occurred to the child. And the reason why they would enjoy that and you wouldn't, okay, one of the reasons why, is because the thought has certainly occurred to you and you've probably seen and experienced things in your life that would indicate that maybe that won't work out. But the child has unquestioned certainty that they will be caught. And they have been. I've thrown my kids up into the air lots of times. And I've caught them like almost every time. Is there anything this morning that you're that certain of? Now, this is a little bit of a trick question because I know we're in church and I know that we're all supposed to say, yes, absolutely. I'm that certain that God is real, that Jesus is his son, that he died on the cross, that he rose from the dead, that he's here with me, that he loves me, he's forgiven my sins, I'm going to heaven. We're supposed to be able to say that. But I just want you to know, we're just going to let the cat out of the bag. That's not true. I mean, what I just said is true, but it's not true that it's unquestioned. Yeah? It's not true that it's unquestioned. We don't know that with unquestioned certainty. We know it, we believe it, and as we grow, that becomes stronger and stronger as we test and see how faithful he really is and how true and dependable his word really is. But it's not that it's unquestioned. We've all experienced, we've all questioned, and we should all question. I mean, is there anything that you're that certain of, like a child being thrown into the air with unquestioned certainty that you will be caught? I mean, I'll just use one example. We all are fairly certain that we will make it to the end of this service. We haven't questioned it. It's not guaranteed. I mean, what are you that certain of? It's just food for thought for now. This is a crazy world. It's a crazy, upside-down, topsy-turvy world, and we're living in a crazy time in a crazy world, for sure. There are definitely things that we never thought would be thrown up for grabs that are all of a sudden up for grabs. What? And we're hoping that everything will be caught and set right, but we don't know. There's a lot of things that we are used to depending on, a lot of things that we were confident in maybe a year ago or 3 years ago or 5 years ago or a generation ago that in our culture for sure just don't seem that rock solid anymore. Is there anything that you're that certain of, unquestioned certainty? Where we are now can be confusing, it can be frightening, it can be maddening, and it's easy in that to get distracted and to get disoriented. And so that's why this morning we're going to go back to the mountain of Galilee in Matthew 28. And so if you have a Bible with you, you can open up there or on your device, find me there in Matthew 28. And I want to read for you this ending of Matthew that we know so well. We were here a few weeks ago, and I wanted to spend a little bit more time there together this morning. Verse 16 starts this way. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. And when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. And then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I am with you always, even to the end of the age." We're going back to this mountain on Galilee, which is not only the mountain of the Great Commission, but it's really a place where Jesus is helping us overcome a mountain of doubt. And I realize that we've been here in recent weeks, but there's just more to it that we need to see together, because I really think this is significant and important for us, especially in a time and a culture where things seem disorienting and distracting, and we can get shaken with our doubts, and sometimes the very fact that we have them is what shakes us. But here are the disciples on a mountain of doubt. And you remember from a couple weeks ago, they were totally disoriented in this process. And Matthew says here that there they are in verse 16, the 11 of them are there on that mountain. And just the fact that he points out, he knows that when he says the 11 disciples are there, he knows that that only draws to our mind one thing, and that is just what an incredibly traumatic experience this has been over the past, you know, number of days. There used to be 12 of them, right? I mean, their very own friend, their brother, is now dead after having taken his life because he betrayed Jesus. Really? How could that even happen? You saw what we saw, you heard what we heard. How could that ever be? And all of the things that they had seen and experienced in this time were just so much to wrap their heads and hearts around. So I think that even when Matthew says there were the 11 of them on that mountain, he knows that he's kind of conjuring up, stirring up those feelings of like, what is going on? We're not even complete here as we're with Jesus together, just the 11 of us. And we read before a couple weeks ago in verse 17 how they saw Jesus and they were worshiping him, but some doubted. And when we were talking about that a couple weeks ago, we were asking this question: what if our doubts were meant to draw us closer to Jesus instead of pushing us away from him? What if our doubts were meant to draw us closer to Jesus instead of pushing us away from him? One of the things that means, and they are, by the way, meant to draw us closer to Jesus, but one of the things that means is that we don't anymore have to run around and pretend that we don't have any doubts. We can acknowledge and be honest with the fact that we really do. And depending on what we're going through and what we're facing and how we're feeling and any number of different things, Pastor Mark shared about some of that yesterday, depending on what you're facing and your attitude about your circumstances, all kinds of things go into whether we feel those doubts or not. But if we're honest with ourselves and honest with one another and honest with the world, we know we've got them, but what are they for? They are for drawing us closer to Jesus, not driving us away from him. See, Matthew was very purposeful here. He's painfully honest about this. When he says there were the 11 disciples and they worshiped him and doubted at the same time, can I just point out to you, this is not the kind of thing you say if you're making up a story to make yourself look good. Which was kind of the accusation at the time for some, was saying that the disciples were making all of this up, that they were involved in some sort of a conspiratorial plot and they were really trying to set themselves up. But when you see the testimony in all of the Gospels and in Acts, you don't see a bunch of guys who got it all together. He is deliberately being painfully honest here as he says, yeah, there we were with Jesus, having been through all of that, knowing that here he is physically in the flesh after having been crucified, and we couldn't help but worship him, but even then, some of us doubted. And we didn't really know what to make of it. He's painfully honest. They're obviously weak, the 11 of them there. Very disoriented. And Matthew is intentionally drawing our attention to Jesus' way of addressing their doubt. And I wanted to come back today and do another layer on this because I think it's so important that we see that the Great Commission was given to us on a great mountain of doubt again. So here's what I mean. When Matthew's drawing our attention to this, if you were to flip back a couple of pages in Matthew 26, there's an encounter there where that you've heard and read about, I'm sure, where after the Last Supper, Jesus said to them in verse 31, "This very night you will all fall away on account of me, for it's written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." And this is the story where Peter says, No, we won't do that. I won't do that for sure. These guys might, but I won't for sure. And you know what happened with that story. But there in verse 32, after he says, "I'll strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered," Jesus said, "But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." Now, if you look at just a couple of verses before where we are in Matthew 28, when Jesus was risen from the dead and he's talking to the ladies there in the garden, they came to him, this is in verse 9, they clasped his feet and worshiped him. And then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, where they will see me." And then here we are in verse 16 and 17. The 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain that Jesus had told them to go. So the point that we're seeing here is that Matthew is intentionally drawing attention to how Jesus is addressing their doubt in this. He's intentionally connecting this back to several times he said before, hey, this is going to happen, but I will rise from the dead and I'll see you on the mountain in Galilee. And then he rose from the dead and he said, don't be afraid as they're worshiping. Just go tell my brothers to go to the mountain where I'm going to see you there in Galilee. And then here they are, exactly as Jesus told them, right there on the mountain of Galilee. So why is it that there is still doubt? I mean, why is that still there? And we know that Jesus had challenged them on this. We heard the story about the road to Emmaus and other places where the disciples are trying to, you know, make sense of what's happening. And he said, why were you so slow to believe what I said? And he challenged them on it a little bit too. But it is just as I told you. Why is there still doubt? Here's why. Even though he had told them, this is a really simple thing. Even though he had told them and made it clear, the reason why is simply this. They were still learning to trust him. That's it. It's not rocket science. Trusting Jesus takes learning. They were still learning to trust him. We're not born with that. It's not inherent in the same way that a child wouldn't be terrified or something when they're thrown up into the air. They were learning to trust him. And I'm trying to say to us this morning that that is what doubt is for. It's to help us learn to trust him. And that's why we said a couple of weeks ago that worship and doubt can exist in the same space. That's what's happening here in verse 17, as we've talked about before. That some worshiped, or they all worshiped, and some doubted. That worship and doubt exist in the same space. And one of the reasons why we're coming back to this today is because of James 1. Do you remember James 1? Let's take a look at that together if you want to flip over there with me. James 1 starts this way in verse 2. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to you. But when you ask, you must believe and not doubt, because the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. That person should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Such a person is double-minded and unstable in all they do. Well, how is it that worship and doubt can and do live in the same space when James 1 tells us that when we ask the Lord for whatever it is that we need, we should ask believing and not doubting, because that kind of person is double-minded and tossed around and should not expect to receive anything. Well, not surprisingly, there's two different words being used here, and I think they're really important for us to understand. In James 1, the word doubt there is diakrino, diakrino. And that word is like a tearing apart. It's a separating from. But back there where we were reading in Matthew 28, when they were worshiping but some doubted, that's a different word. That's a distasso. Distasso. So diakrino and distasso are two different words. Diakrino means like a tearing apart or a separating, where distasso means like double checking. You know? Have you done this where you say like, wait, what? Are you sure? So the disciples, as they've seen all they've seen, they've been with Jesus this whole time. Here he is, raised from the dead. They're worshiping him, and they're still doubting. They're still double checking this thing to make sure: is this real? Do you really mean it? Are you sure? The difference is really important. One is a tearing apart. The other one's like a double checking. One is a I'm out, and the other is, are you sure? And this is important because of what he's about to say next. A number of years ago now, I sold my car. I know this is going to be exciting for you car people. I had a 1997 Dodge Stratus. That's right. 5-speed Dodge Stratus. I mean, it was like every accountant's dream. You know, librarians drove those things. You know, people like that. So I drove this car for 17 years. We bought it right after we came here. And trust me, no one ever imagined when they built that car that it would make it for 17 years. It was not designed to last for 17 years, but we did it. We drove that car all through our youth ministry years and beyond that. When we lived here on the church campus and lived down the road, and we took it on all of our trips for a little while. It was our only family car, so we just put tons and tons of miles on this car. And finally, after all of the things, and there were a lot of things, it was time to sell it. I'll give you an example of one of them, and there's so many to choose from, but one of them was my horn, the switch in the steering wheel, malfunctioned. And I don't understand how this worked exactly, but if you got too much on an upward plane, the horn would beep by itself, which is a problem if any of you remember where we used to live. We used to live in a cul-de-sac on a very, very steep driveway. I mean, really, really steep. It was long and steep. And so every time I would come home for that stretch of time and come up my own driveway, I would announce to all the neighbors that I was home. And playing up the plateau. It's really difficult at night. They're like, okay, we're home. We know. We get it. You know, every time. So finally, I had to disconnect it all and make my own little switch under the steering wheel, you know, so I could, you know, whenever I needed to. And I always had to explain it to the inspection people. It's okay. It's legal. Trust me. Just, you know, whatever. Well, finally, we decided to sell this car. And I didn't really know what to expect. Didn't have high expectations for sure. Put it out on Craigslist. Got a call or two. You know, people would ask questions. They wouldn't talk to me anymore. But there's this one time this guy called. And he had this deep, imposing, booming voice.
Yeah, man, you got this Dodge Stratus?
Yeah.
Well, can I come take a look at it?
Sure. So we arranged a time. We met here at the church. And he pulled up, and he had this giant Jeep, like big custom tires, sparkling rims, all just tricked out with all kinds of amazing features, this incredibly valuable, big, strong vehicle. And he opened his door, and he stepped out, and this guy had the physique and the persona of Mike Tyson. I mean, I'm not making that up. And the only thing different is that he had the voice that Mike Tyson should have had, you know? He stepped out of this car on one side. His girl stepped out of the car on the other side with their little poodle or whatever it was. What in the world is this?
Can I take it for a drive?
Okay. So I give him my keys. He goes off. I'm standing there talking to the poodle lady for a few, and he comes back. I'm like, what in the world? And I said, well, I'd give him a few, like, just the horns under there and, you know, whatever. We can go our separate ways now or whatever. What did you think? And he goes,
I loved it.
What? Are you serious?
I loved it. I'll take it.
And he did. And I don't know what to tell you. I just, for the next week or two, I was watching the news to see if my car would be, you know, involved in something or whatever. I just, everything about it sounded, but I remember looking at that guy when he said, I'll take it. I'm like physically, you're just going to take it now? You're going to give me money? Okay, you're going to pay me. But I thought he was just going to just take it. He bought my car. I have no idea why. I mean, I'm looking at this guy like, are you serious? Are you sure you want this car? And I second-guessed it. I wondered, like, is there something about this car, 1997 Dodge Strat? I shouldn't be selling it. I don't know. When the disciples are right there on this mountain, and they're worshiping and they're doubting, and Jesus looks at them and he says, all authority has been given to me. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations. They're going, what? Are you sure? This sounds like a terrible idea. Why would you ever do that? There's 11 of us. You know what happened to the 12th. We're worshiping you, doubting you in real time. We are totally disoriented, completely off our game. We don't even know what we believe right now. And the next thing that Jesus does is give them the greatest commission of all time, upon which the eternity of nations would rest. Are you sure? That's distazo. Are you sure? And you double check and you look to him and you see him again. He's sure. Look at him. He's sure. But the other kind of doubt in James, diakrino, is a tearing apart. It's an I'm out. I just can't. I'm not going to try that. I'm not going there. I'm out. And what I'm trying to say to us this morning is that doubt is always present in the life of a believer to some extent right now. And the reason why I know that is because doubt and faith are not opposites. Doubt and faith are not opposites. In fact, they kind of require one another, if you think about it. What is faith? We learn that from Hebrews. Faith is being sure of what we hope for, certain of what we do not see. If you read that through, you can see all of it's being tested. All of it's being tested and tried and questioned, and it's found secure. And faith is the growing, learning to trust Jesus, leaning on him, trusting him, and finding him secure in the worst possible things, in the most frustrating, dark, I have no idea where this is going, how in the world is this going to work out, are you sure, is the kind of doubt that we're called to. We're actually called to it, to keep looking at him and going, are you sure? Are you there? Yes, you are. I see you. You're sure. And when we see him, then we're strengthened in that, and our faith can take over. But not the kind of doubt that says, I'm out. I'm not gonna find out. I'm not going there with you. The opposite of faith is unbelief, not doubt. Faith actually assumes doubt, if you think about it. What's the opposite of doubt? Unquestioned certainty. Unquestioned certainty. The baby gets thrown up into the air, and without even thinking about it, they know they're going to be caught and safe. Jesus came to earth because unquestioned certainty was lost in the garden. Remember what he said to the folks around with Zacchaeus? That the Son of Man came to seek and save what was lost. What was lost? Unquestioned certainty. In the garden, walking with God, fellowship, no sin, no brokenness, perfect relationship. There was nothing but unquestioned certainty. You'll catch me every time. Throw me around. I don't care. But since then, we've got so many questions, so much brokenness, so many doubts. And if we're not careful as believers, then we'll either pretend like we don't have them, which is not actually good for our faith, or we'll have the James 1 kind of doubt that says, that's it, I'm out. When really what he's saying is, go ahead, worship, see me, check, lean on me, trust me, try me, I will come through, you'll see. Keep checking, keep looking, keep finding out how very trustworthy I am. Go ahead, bring your doubt, I can take it. That's what we're called to. Jesus came to earth because unquestioned certainty was lost in the garden. But as we were singing earlier, he is making all things new. And there is coming a time, faith, hope, and love, when not even faith or hope are required anymore. Because we'll be with him forever, and there we will have, once again, unquestioned certainty. Unlike any other time in our life. So let me wrap it up this way. How does Jesus address our doubt on this mountain? What does he do with it? Number one, he reminds us. He reminds us that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. All of it. All authority is mine. He reminds us who he is, what belongs to him, And if there had been any doubt before, now the resurrected Jesus, having conquered death and hell itself, can stand there and say, in heaven, everything you don't see, and on earth, everything you do see, all authority, mine. Unquestioned, unrivaled, unchallenged, at least not for long. So he reminds us that all authority is mine. And then, secondly, he raises us to be a part of our mission, or his mission. It's really, it's astonishing. And that's when you want to look and you go like, Jesus, are you sure? Are you sure this is your plan? Yes, I'm raising you up to be a part of my mission because I love you and I love them. Who? Everyone. I love everyone. And it's good for us to remember that Jesus absolutely loves everyone but does not love everything. Right? Because what we're being told is if you don't love everything I do, then you don't love me. Not so. He loves everyone, not everything. Why? Because some things hurt us and he loves us. Yeah? So he raises us to be a part of his love for all nations, all people, everyone, everywhere, anyone can be welcomed into his family because of his shed blood on the cross. So he reminds us that all authority is his. He raises us to be a part of his mission. Then he requires us to do and to teach all he commands, which is pretty impressive when you think about it. He requires us. He doesn't say, hey, I know you've got your doubts. You get them worked out and then come get back to me. He says, no, in the meantime, I'm okay with you having your doubts. Check on me, lean on me, trust me, try me. I'll prove myself faithful, but in the meantime, I want you to do and teach what I commanded. And I'm requiring that of you. And he requires of us not just so that, you know, he's right, but because it's how we learn to trust him. It's good for us. And then finally, he reassures us. At all times, even through the end of the age, I will be with you. And if you think about what really gives that child the unquestioned certainty is not just the fact that, you know, the absence of questions, but also it's the presence of their dad or their mom or their, you know, it's, I know you've got me. And so he reminds us that all authority is his. He raises us up to be a part of his mission. He requires us in the meanwhile to do and to teach his commands. And then finally, he reassures us, I will never, ever, ever, ever leave you alone, come what may. That's good news. Let's go back to Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord. Come on, say it with me. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight.